at me, I be work, 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 work. You see me do me dirt, 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 dirt. That's something about that work, 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 work. When you walk along.
Welcome to WITWORKS Radio. In this episode, Abby Pober, Assistant Director of Co-ops and Careers, and Co-op and Career Advisors Rhea Kalinowski and Becky Smith sit down with Professor Aaron Carpenter for the second installment of our grad school series. Let's listen into their conversation from January 29th about PhD programs.
I'm a professor of computer engineering at Wentworth Institute of Technology. So we started our talk about graduate school last semester. We talked about the basics of grad school and details about master's program. And today we're going to focus on PhD and other graduate degree programs.
Hi, I'm Aaron Carpenter. To give you some background on my role in graduate school, I completed my bachelor's in 2005, master's in 2006, and PhD in 2012, all from the University of Rochester, New York, all in electrical and computer engineering. I spent 3 years teaching in ECE at Binghamton University in New York. I was advising undergraduate and graduate students in my research labs. I then came to Wentworth in 2015, where I've been focusing on undergraduate education, and hopefully preparing you undergraduate students for graduate school as well.
Thanks for being with us today, Aaron.
And thank you for having me.
So let's start off by talking a little bit about the structure of a PhD program.
Sure. A PhD is definitely a very large undertaking, so some people get scared off pretty easily. It needs to be considered carefully. It can take 4 years all the way up to seven or more if you're going full-time, and that's beyond a master's degree. Although you sometimes will get a master's along the way. That could be more or less depending on your topic and your advisor. They all have different requirements, and I put that in quotes, for their graduation. Because it is very difficult and because it is a very large time commitment, you need to have a really good reason to get into the PhD. The main reasons are you want to go into academia, you know, college professor, or maybe you want to do cutting-edge research, you want to be at a university or a research lab, or it could be that you just really love the research side and that's the part that you want to explore. These types of jobs require often a PhD or a lot of experience, but if your reasons for a PhD are things like, I want to be called doctor, which for the record, nobody calls me that, or I don't have a job, so I think I'll go to grad school, or my parents or family want me to go get a PhD. Those are all directions that will burn you out. You will spend years fighting it, and eventually you'll just say, I don't want to do this anymore, which I've had people do when they go have long, successful careers elsewhere, but the PhD is sometimes hard to manage that. It's a dark road sometimes. It's long and it's hard. So it's important to have that real motivation behind it. In my case, it was I knew I wanted to teach and at a university level, and thus I needed my PhD. You have to have the light at the end of the tunnel. You will also be building a fellow grad student network, typically with your lab, and this becomes sort of your academic family. So keep that in mind as you head towards it. You've got your advisor who will be in charge of everything about your life for many years. And then you have all the other people who will maybe be working with a project or on a project with you. It could be people that are just in the lab that you see, people they have meetings with. But the general structure ends up being you spend your time doing research and taking some courses, usually to supplement your research as opposed to just do sort of exploratory foundational things like you would in an undergrad or graduate program.
Aaron, you had mentioned requirements in quotes, and I wonder if you could tell more about that, because I started to think if I were an undergraduate student and I were exploring PhD programs, I was trying to figure out maybe even whether to pursue a master's first and then apply for PhD programs. Is that information right out there, or is it a little more subtle?
It's more subtle for sure. I can only talk about myself, which is I did explorations in ECE for exploring a PhD. I went to a school that will remain nameless, so I don't burn bridges and cut ties. That I went and talked to their graduate students when I had gotten admitted, and they listed, literally, you had to have this many publications in this many journals and this many conferences before you were allowed to graduate. It has to be quality, not it has to be really great work. It's literally a number. You have to have say, 3 journals and 5 conferences. And if you don't get that, you can't graduate. That is a requirement in some places, and that is very dependent on the advisor. Other places will be, and this was more like mine, was I want a really quality publication out of it. I want really great research. And if you only publish twice for all of it, that's fine. That's different on different fields as well. So I do engineering or computer engineering where it's a lot of conference proceedings. You have to go do presentations, where other places you have to do journals and magazine articles. Then it could be, in terms of requirements, how much time you have to put in. There are some places that say you have to be there for a certain amount of time. Some people actually say how much per week. So you have to be there for 50 hours a week in the lab live. And then there's others that say work from wherever you want, because you can, as long as you're making progress, it doesn't matter. That very much depends on which field you're in, who your advisors would be, and sort of how that program runs. And that differs wildly based on where you are.
So similarly to doing research on companies for full-time jobs, so you want to know the company culture, you want to know about the industry, do some informational interviews, it's kind of a similar path to pick grad schools.
Yes, absolutely. You have to do your due diligence in terms of internet searches, talking to people. You should be looking at things like, how many students does your advisor have? So if they have 3 or 4, that means you're probably going to have a very close relationship with your advisor. If they have 40 and then 3 postdocs and a research assistant, you might never, ever, ever see your advisor. It's something you have to look at their websites. You have to look at where their current students are. You have to go there and talk to people. Similar to undergrad, you want to go and actually, you know, sit in a room and hear people talk. You have to do that. At a PhD level, you need to talk to the grad students, because mm-hmm. they live that life.
Yeah.
They know what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And there is not the same sense of community on a campus level at PhD. It's more just your close-knit people. And so who's in that lab, who's the advisor, who are the people you interact with every day? So it'd be like going to work for a huge company. You don't necessarily need to know everything about the company. You need to know about the office mates that you would have, or the team that you would be working on. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to get that just from internet searches, although you can find some base level information from that as well.
Is there a question that you, once now that you're through the program, once you got in there, was there a question that you didn't ask that you wish you had asked?
I'm unique in that I went to the same place that I did my undergraduate. I knew my advisor ahead of time.
Sure.
And so I got a lot of questions answered before I got there. The question that I do think that people need to know going in is sort of, what is your life going to feel like for a while?
Hmm.
And this isn't, I'm not always speaking from experience, but from secondhand, or, you know, seeing things on the outside. But I know people who just can't stand their labs because they spend 60, 70 hours a week, and there's somebody looking over their shoulder the whole time. And, you know, if you have a family, or if you want to have a social life, those are hard things to handle. So
sure.
It's something that, you know, just asking the graduate students, like, what, how do you spend your day is probably a really good way to, or how do you spend your week? And that is very indicative of how your life will be like. Now, some people need that structure, and they crave to, you know, they want to be in the lab for that long. I wanted to keep business hours 8 to 5 and then go home and not have to think too much about it. And depending on your advisor, some will grant that flexibility, some won't. So it's something that the advisor won't necessarily tell you that, by the way. The advisor is going to tell you all the things you want to hear so that you come and work for them.
Yeah.
The students, on the other hand, will tell you everything.
Sounds
so, ask them.
Much like a job interview process.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you find the grads, like, students that you, like, I guess it starts with finding the program that you're interested in, and then the project that you want to work on, and then, I mean, are they on LinkedIn? Like, I mean, that's...
Yeah, so I've actually had people reach out from my current, or my past advisor, who now are, they're currently advisees of his, and they reach out to me and say, can you just talk to me? So LinkedIn will work, yeah.
Does he recommend you as a contact, or do you mean they kind of look around on LinkedIn?
I think both. So they can see what kind of work they'd be working on, and so they'll look at a paper that he did, which would probably have my name on the front for, you know, any number of them. And so they would say, okay, well, where is this person now? Okay, he's over here. Let me contact him on LinkedIn, or I'll get an email. Other ways is when you do the campus visit. Mm-hmm. Some will have websites of a list of the lab people. Somebody who's decent at keeping this up to date, my advisor always was it'll list who's currently in, what they're working on, and then who's out and where do they go.
Oh, cool.
And so, you know, you could say one of my colleagues was at NVIDIA, and then another one went to Intel, and another one went into teaching. And so that you can see that and sort of track it through. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in the internet age. Everybody's out there. So you just got to go find them usually.
Sure.
To get a real conversation, you need to be in the room. You need to sit with them and sort of see what that lab space is really like.
Mm-hmm. So is there a certain way you recommend students trying to find an advisor or a program that they're interested in?
Yeah, so your advisor is going to determine a lot about your life for the next however many years. They will determine what your specialty is, although that's usually something you've chosen them for as well. They'll figure out your projects. They may even tell you schedules. But you choose them as much as they choose you. So they accept you into it, but you also potentially have more than one option. So when you go looking, you're going to look for not just the reputation of a school. Like, you know, you're not going to say, oh, I just want to go to this school because I know it's a great school. They may not be focused on what you want to focus on. So you need to look at what are they working on, where are they putting their effort and their funds, and then that will help to sort of suss out who you're going to work with. Then after you've figured out all of the labs you want to potentially work in, you do more digging, just kind of like you would if you were looking for a job. Mm-hmm. And for the record, PhD is very much a job for those years, so don't underestimate that. The advisor will help to entice your acceptance by trying to give you a stipend, hopefully, which will usually cover your tuition cost and then rough cost of living. Now, that is variable based on where you are. I've had colleagues who pay whatever the bare minimum is, and I've had colleagues who pay what legitimately is like a research position to try to attract just the best students. That's very much dependent on who you're working with, where they're getting their money, what field you're in. Engineering, you should expect an assistantship of some kind for a PhD, or at least seek one out, whereas humanities and social sciences, you may not have quite as much in terms of funding. It very much depends in that case. Excuse me. But everybody has a different experience with their advisor, so how you find them and how you work with them is going to vary quite a bit. Hopefully in the future, you'll hear people being interviewed from all around Wentworth and all around the community on this podcast to see sort of what theirs was like. But you do need to have a strong working relationship with them. You'll spend a lot of time with them. You'll get to know them pretty well. In my case, you know, I know my advisor's children and his wife. I spent time in their house. I know them very well. We also had a decent working relationship where he knew that my style was leave me alone. I'll do it. I'll figure this out. I don't like being micromanaged. And we worked well that way. Whereas if I had had an advisor where I had a micromanager, I probably would have quit because it would have driven me insane. Again, that's something you need to talk about with the lab group or reach out to them somehow. Because they are potentially a source of funding and money, that means you're hopefully getting paid. So there is a little bit of an employer-employee dynamic where if you're not pulling your weight, there's going to be potential issues. And sometimes it's mutual where, you know, I'm just not interested in this anymore. I want to switch labs or something like that. But hopefully you find one through your specialty and through whatever other constraints you have. Maybe you want to stay in the Northeast or you want to go abroad or something like that. And then they pay for it. Knock on wood. That's what we're hoping for, at least. Because it doesn't mean you're going to get a lot of money, by the way. Most PhDs will pay for you to live, maybe with roommates, to eat, and not extravagantly. Mm-hmm. You'll have health insurance, hopefully, through the school and things like that. But it's basically enough to live. Don't expect to go, you know, leasing Mercedes or something like that right off the bat.
Uh-huh. Right away.
Our listeners might have gotten curious when you mentioned switching labs. Is a person who switches labs still able to get their PhD from that same school? And this may vary, but could you speak at all about whether they're able to stay on track or that might add a year or two?
Yeah, so I've had in just my lab alone, I've had a bunch. So there's people who left because they found a job and they just wanted to go work. We've had people who switched to a new lab inside of the same school. And that's usually just a matter of figuring out if the other advisor can take on another student and if there's funding opportunities there as well. If it's early on, it usually doesn't add any time. I've also had somebody who was, I think they were 4 years into a PhD and their advisor left for another school. And usually when that happens, you have the option of going to the new school. They'll bring the graduate student with them. That graduate student elected to stay and reset entirely a new lab. They spent another 6 years on their PhD. So they spent 10 years at that. They were there for more than some of the faculty that were there. And
so they maintained that very simple lifestyle for another 4 years. Yes. And that meant they worked really hard.
Yeah. So they had, that's one of the longer ones that I've had, but he found another advisor. He was really interested in that project. And so he was willing to put in the time, and he was fine with the sort of minimalistic living arrangement for a little while.
A lot of learning.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he got to stay in the geographic location he wanted to be in.
It's kind of like switching majors. If you do it in your first year, it's pretty simple. If you do it in your senior year, you're probably going to have some problems because you're going to have to take all these prereqs and you're going to have to get back up to speed. It takes time again.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the stipend, and is being a TA part of that, or is that different?
It could be. So there's two different, well, there's scholarships, which would just be, or fellowships, which is usually from an outside source. If you're going to fellowship, the NSF has a graduate fellowship program. A lot of the DOD contracts do. Again, I'm speaking for ECE. But assistantships come in either research or teaching. So a teaching assistantship will be your TA. You're going to be doing grading, maybe teaching some classes. That is very dependent on where you are. The big universities, you'll often be teaching a class, whereas the smaller ones, you'll probably be doing a lab or doing a lot of grading. Maybe you'll have office hours. And then the research assistantship is you're going to get paid to do research. That's the usual end goal for any PhD, is to get a research assistantship, because you're going to spend most of your time doing the research. So if you're going to spend 50, 60, 80 hours a week doing it, you might as well get paid for it.
Yeah.
And the teaching assistantships is variable, but at my school, at least, you did that in your first year. You were TA, and then after that, you were an RA. So it lowers the impact on the advisor to take on a new student without it being a burden of, here, I've got to spend all this extra money, but still gives them the opportunity to get to the school, get paid, and work for a little while before they make a final decision.
Interesting.
And I think you mentioned this a little bit, but so you're taking classes along with the PhD to supplement the research you're doing. Is that right?
Yeah, so you'll take some classes usually early on. You'll take a bunch of classes. That could be as part of a master's degree if you're getting that along the way. But mainly it'll be to support your PhD research. So most PhD granting institutions will have faculty that will teach a specialty class in their area. And so you'll just sort of bounce around from class to class looking for, you'll have to do some level of credits. Maybe you'll have to do 10 classes over the 5 years or something. Some of those could be independent studies where you're working, you're still doing work. It could be projects. What you'll end up doing is once you've run out of classes that you have to take, you'll often just ask to sit in. Because most places, if you've got, 10 people in a PhD level class, having an extra one to just participate in discussions isn't going to be a big deal. So you might audit them or sit in. Audit takes money because you pay for the credit, but just sitting in, you can ask like the professor, hey, am I allowed to sit in here? I won't bug you. I won't send you email questions. I just want to listen and absorb. And so you basically just get the lectures. And so that's a really great way to just learn some extra stuff. And I did that throughout my entire PhD, just asking people, can I just sit here? And then I get to skip the coursework.
Nice.
And I am with you, Aaron, in that I don't like to be micromanaged, but I do find that I need structure. So I can imagine myself, I've never done a PhD, but I can imagine as a PhD student, I might do that to add some structure and or help me stay motivated if I'm working on my own independent work.
Yeah, it is good to also have the thing that is different from your research, because you're spending a lot of time sort of your head down working on something. So to be able to pop up and, you know, have conversations and learn something new is good. It also structures your day a little bit more, so it gives you a reason to, you know, get out of bed. And in PhD, that means somewhere around 1 o'clock in the afternoon and show up at 2 and then stay until past midnight and all that. So it does give you a little bit more structure in there for sure. But in the end, you will spend 60 to 80 hours a week just doing research. I once got an email from, not my advisor, but a group of advisors in the school that said, if you aren't working 80 hours a week on your research, don't expect to graduate anytime soon.
Okay.
And so that doesn't mean you have to be in the space. It means you're at home doing reading, things like that. But you're going to spend most of your time doing that. You'll be learning. It won't be in terms of a class. It'll be reading papers and reading books and talking to people, doing presentations, going to conferences, publishing stuff, disseminating all your research results. So you still find these things that you have to do that provide deadlines and structure, but it'll come in a much more holistic way based on what your project and what your field is, more so than just doing the coursework. Of course, you'll take some courses. It's natural because it helps to build your understanding of the whole field.
All right, I think this is a good time for a quick break, so we're going to step away for just a moment, and we'll be back in a minute.
One.
And we're back.
So if you're just joining us, we're talking about graduate school, especially the PhD program with Aaron Carpenter, and we're ready to dive into the dissertation.
Sure. So the main component for all of your PhD activities will be a dissertation. It'll be around original research and publications. And the dissertation is what you will, at the end, have to submit to get your degree. And so you'll have to write this very lengthy thing and hand it to somebody and your committee, and they'll actually file it at the school. It ends up being a textbook of sorts. And what I mean by that is in terms of size
and weight
and breadth and depth and everything. So I've seen them at about 200 pages, which is around where mine was. I've seen over 400. And those get legitimately turned into textbooks. You can buy them now. I can recommend them if you want. And that dissertation is kind of a collection of all of your publications, all of the research information that you've gathered, all the data. In terms of engineering, that is often a lot of data, graphs, figures, tables. In terms of humanities and social sciences, it wouldn't be that type of data. It would be different types of information. And then you have to defend that dissertation in public. So a public defense means you're going to stand up in front of your committee. The committee is made up of faculty within your department, outside your department, maybe even outside of the school entirely. And you will they will read your dissertation, not so much for editing, but just to make sure that you're doing your job and that you're worthy of the degree. And then you also have to do it publicly, meaning that anybody can come. So you can show up and just walk in and sit down at somebody's public defense. Not everybody wants that publicly advertised because you'd rather do it to a small room, as I wanted to. But usually you'll have a small group of graduate students who will also sit in to see what they're in for in the future. Your advisor will help you through that process, most likely. They will make sure that you don't try to graduate until you're ready to graduate. So that means you will walk into that room as nervous as can be, because I was for sure. But if you're already in the room, you've already done most of the work. You're 99% of the way there, and you just need to make sure you cross that last finish line piece, which in this case is the public presentation. After you do the public side, they ask the public people to leave, and then it's just you and the faculty committee. And that's when the real fun starts, because they can ask you anything. And they will ask you anything. And so you have to really come in prepared. And they're just making sure that the degree that you're about to get is you've earned it, and that you can prove it. That dissertation and its defense basically is proving to people that you are the leading expert in that field. Now, that field is largely very esoteric, meaning that like no one else is trying to be the expert in that particular field, but there might be three or four other people. For example, when I finished mine, I was able to lead a workshop with one or two other people that we were the only three people who even knew that this was a thing. And so I was the expert on that topic. That's after, you know, lots of conference publications and journals and workshops and things like that to build up to it. But the dissertation's that big book that at the end you get to say, I owned this. And then you get it bound in leather and put your name in Boston gold on the top and never open it again. Never. I open it still. The moment I open it to any page out of 200 pages, I will look and find a typo.
Oh, man.
I will look at it and go, nope, that's the wrong word.
Yeah,
so it's been 7 years I still do that. That's why I don't open it anymore.
And the work is never done.
Yeah, never done. It's always an iterative process.
What was your dissertation?
My dissertation was on, I'm going to see if I can get the title right because it's not going to be right. It is on using global transmission lines for on-chip shared interconnect for efficiency. So basically, on a microprocessor, can we do things at light speed using analog signals instead of digital signals, which is what we typically do? And can we do that with one sort of broadcast, where instead of having to tell everything on the chip individually, you just yell to the whole chip like, hey, I'm doing this thing. And then everything can catch it. And so we were using a particular thing called a transmission line, an on-chip transmission line, To do that broadcast. And so it was a little bit of architecture and programming, and it was a little bit more device and physics level. And I had collaborators that covered the things that my advisor couldn't do. So my advisor was a computer programming, computer scientist, architect. We had to get people who could do the devices and understand how do I actually build it. And so that was a team thing. And so it wasn't just one lab. Sometimes you work across a few.
That's cool. So last semester we talked about our master's, and now we've talked a little bit about the PhD. Are there, before we get into that, is there anything else you want to add about the PhD that we didn't touch upon?
Yeah, sure. So with the PhD, it's good if you can do something that you are passionate about.
Spend a lot of time on it.
You're going to spend countless hours and frustrating nights doing all these things. To give you an idea of what that might feel like is you're working normally, let's say 60 hours a week. We'll go on the conservative or lower end. And then a deadline is coming in a week. And because we're academia and all the students who are listening know exactly what I'm talking about, you're not going to start writing the paper until the day before. This is true at all levels. It doesn't matter that you're a student. It doesn't matter if you're a professor. I still have colleagues who do this. So you will wait till the last second, and then the deadline is at midnight. But wait, the deadline is at midnight Pacific time. And I'm on the East Coast, which means actually the paper is due at 3 a.m. But wait, they're going to delay it by an hour because the submission site went down. It always does, which means it's 4 a.m. So for like 3 days, you're spending 24 hours a day. I've slept on my desk in my PhD and just waiting for my advisor just to come down and go, yep, paper's done. Because I'll submit a revision and they'll have to do something. So it has to be something you really like to do. Or at least something that you can tolerate high levels of for a very long time.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining about that. It got publications. Those conferences and journals that I got to go and like present at conferences turned me into what I am today. I can present in public. I think I'm good at presenting when I do these kinds of things. And I'm comfortable with it. But if I didn't get that opportunity and if I hated what I was doing, it would have been a real problem.
Sure.
So try to find something that you are really passionate about. It's a trying time. And so when I talk about the PhD, students come to my office and they say, should I do a PhD? And my default answer is no, you don't. And so it's no. And then, well, are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure you don't want to do the PhD. Okay. But I kind of want to do the PhD. No, you don't want to do the PhD. But I want to go into teaching. Okay, now we're there. And so like it needs to be something you've really thought about the end result for so that you know what the goal is. And so like I am here at Wentworth because I love the teaching aspect of computer engineering. And my advisor once told the people that I was asking for a reference when I was getting a job to be a professor. But the person who had interviewed me said, oh, he told us that you like the teaching side too much because I loved it. And so, like, he was right, for the record. I'm very much into the teaching side of this, but I knew that was my goal, was I wanted to be a teacher. And if you wanted to do the research, then that's great, but you need to find the motivation and the passion behind it because it's hard to leave it and feel good about it. People drop out all the time, and they'll, you know, it's got a pretty bad retention rate if you're just looking at numbers, but the people who leave go find jobs and they go do great things, and typically they have a master's along the way. But if you are really committed to it, you need to really have something in there because it's hard.
Yeah. So are there other options besides a master's or a PhD?
Yeah, sure. So I'll speak for all the people who I have no right to speak for. So there's MBA. So if you're interested in business and things like that, go talk to our business department, for the record. There's law, if you wanted to. There's all different levels of law, by the way. You could get a Juris Doctorate, which is a PhD level, but in law. There's obviously medical, which I don't like blood, so I was out automatically on that one. All of them are similar in the sense that they are a real commitment. For example, medical, my brother-in-law is a neurologist. He spent years and years and years doing the degree part. Then he spent years and years doing apprenticeship and residency and bouncing around the country until finally he, you know, landed his own practice and things like that. It takes a long time. The same is true for all of these. So you need to be aware that these are out there and go find something that you're interested in. Mm. For those of you who are in engineering, an MBA is going to give you the business aspect of what you're doing in engineering. So you might end up on a team that does more sales and more marketing and more business side than you would on the actual physical level. It's a lot easier to transition than you might think because undergraduate is preparing you to think. As much as you think that we're driving you insane with busy work, which for the record, people in my programming class, I am trying to drive you insane with busy work. The point of undergraduate is to prepare you to just think analytically and critically about anything. And so if we've done our jobs, you could jump into anything that you want. You'll have to take some extra courses. You'll have to do a little bit of digging on your own. But if you wanted to switch majors entirely, that's not crazy. It happens all the time. Mm-hmm. If it's a closely related field, it's easier. If it's a widely different field, it's harder. So it's all over the place. But if you wanted to go in any of those directions, find somebody to talk to about it that is an expert in it. Wentworth has tons of people who have all of these degrees, so go find them.
Mm-hmm. And alumni are a great resource as well.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So what about, you mentioned conferences a little bit. Is there anything you wanted to add about what that looks like in terms of attending or presenting? Or?
Sure. So if you're an undergraduate, try to go to one anyway, because good news, we live in Boston, and there's a lot of stuff here. So you can actually find close by conferences to go and just sit in. You might need to, you're going to have to pay some money. But if you go to these things, you can potentially see what it's like on the outside. It's a lot of networking. So my advisor used to tell me to go, you know, try to talk to new people and everything, which I, of course, did not do because I would rather be in the hotel by myself than talking to all these people. But I forced myself to talk to enough. I actually had one friend in another lab that if the advisor caught that person talking to someone they already knew, the advisor would come over and say, nope, and separate them to force them to talk to just random people so they sort of spread their network out.
Not even one warm-up conversation.
No, I would try to talk to my friend, and the advisor would come over and go, "You know him. Stop." And so you could see them sort of looking side eye, like, "Okay, where's my advisor? I just need a minute to talk to somebody who I already know." Beyond that, it's an opportunity to see what the cutting edge of everything is. So you're gonna see conference presentations. You're gonna see keynote speakers. You're gonna see things that aren't published yet. This is literally the day that they are getting published. So you're going to get the cutting, bleeding edge of your field. And if you get to present at them, usually it's 20-minute presentations. That depends a little bit. But it's PowerPoint, and you stand up in front of the room and give your PowerPoint. Then there's a question and answer session. And then usually there's time for your people to talk afterwards as well. It is a great opportunity even for undergrads. Don't just think that this is for PhDs. It's a good thing for people to do across no matter what field you're in. Explore publishing. Quick shout out to, there's a new student journal that is research journal that will be starting this semester that Juval Rosales and Ryan Rogers and I are part of. That is supposed to be the undergraduate version of this here at Wentworth. And so if you want to see sort of what that editorial process is like, you can find out from us also.
Yeah.
And also if you just want to do conferences, talk to IEEE or ASME or whatever your professional society is and see what they do because they do things that are similar as well.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully throughout your career here, you're going to get the opportunity to do these presentations so you feel comfortable with it. But it's basically you're going out there and you're seeing who the experts in your field are and mingling with them. And half the time it's just, you know, doing fun, having a not free lunch because you're paying the registration fees, but having lunch and talking to people at your table and meeting new people. And it's a good way to sort of expand your, let's just call it the LinkedIn profile for now.
Sure.
Because that's how we're all going to do it. It's just, I know you now, so I'm going to add you on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I suggest everybody go out and try that regardless of if you're doing the PhD. It's just good professional development mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, and it's good networking in general. I mean, you never know when someone's going to have, if you're not interested in research, like have a job available or know someone who has a job, and it's a good practice to get into anyway.
Or if you're in a major where there are a bunch of different things you can do with your major, you're not sure what you'll do yet, You might just find that spark by going to a conference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Well, I think that that's all we're going to touch on today for PhDs. But in the next installment of our graduate school series, we're going to talk about how to find a program and what the application process entails. So thank you again for joining us, Aaron, and we'll talk with you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Aaron. And just a couple of last-minute things here. Advisors, do you have any important dates you want to share that you can think of? I know I have one. Students, you should save the date for the spring career fair. The co-op and career fair is going to be Tuesday, March 19th from 3 to 7. We haven't opened registration yet, but we will be in the next couple weeks. So look out for some emails from us before you head out for spring break. And look on our Twitter. If you want to interact with us on social media, you can tweet us at Witt Co-ops and Careers. And drop-in hours this semester are Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 1:30 to 4. And if you're a computer science student, we have Rocket Software in the office right now reviewing resumes and cover letters. So go meet an employer, get your questions answered, all that good stuff.
Or other relevant majors or people who love programming, feel free to come by.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity. I think that's it. All right, everyone. Have a great week. Thank you for joining us.